From the perspective of the practice of medicine, the 17th and 18th centuries represent a period of fascinating paradox. On the one hand, this was a period of tremendous and ever-increasing scientific discovery and expansion. The 18th century would be regarded as the period of the Enlightenment, especially in the area of philosophy, where the dogmas of the past would be cast aside and fresh new ideas would be tested. It's the period of the rise of new political ideas and the foundation of the developing democracies. On the one hand, there was this tremendous expansion and desire to learn new things and take advantage of them. But on the other, from the perspective of the practice of medicine, there was an increasing hardening and even dogmatic clinging to earlier ideas, even in the face of this new science. And that is nowhere more apparent than in the burgeoning sciences of microscopy and microbiology. That is, the development of microscopes, attaching lenses to various devices and providing light sources, enabled people to look at extremely small objects. And one of the most famous early microscopists is the lens grinder and craftsman Anton von Leeuwenhoek, who lived in Holland. And although he had no real scientific training per se, became quite widely revered and respected as someone who was able to produce instruments that enabled one to look at extremely small objects. And in section 1.1, I've given you a picture both of Leeuwenhoek himself and a depiction of one of his microscopes. Now, this is an extremely small object. It's only about 3 inches long, and this is one of huge numbers of these microscopes that he made. When Leeuwenhoek discovered that he could see fascinating surfaces and various characteristics of objects, that some of which were invisible to the naked eye, he realized that people would only believe him if he could enable them to see what he had seen. And so he would make a microscope for each object he wanted to see, and then he would save them with the specimen attached to the microscope. So effectively, each one became a way of reviewing his findings and allowing his those who would come to investigate his work to be able to see for themselves the objects that he'd been looking at. But of course, he spent a great deal of time acquiring the patience necessary to use this single-lensed microscope as a way of looking at extremely small objects. And he published several times collections of what he had seen. He communicated with the developing Royal Society in England. His findings were confirmed by some of the members of that developing scientific organization. And I've given you in below those initial pictures of Leeuwenhoek and his microscope some pictures of some of the things he saw, some of the, as he called them, animalcules, very, very tiny beasts, very small creatures. And he would draw pictures of fleas and water nymphs and various other kinds of things, but also the small organisms that one finds in pond water, which you find particularly on the right. But on the left, especially interesting, are some very large bacteria, which he was able to see. And he noted that these very, very small objects tended to be found on what we would call corrupt and decaying matter, the material that he might scrape off his teeth or found in other places. So this and other observations were effectively laying the groundwork for microbiology, for the study of very small organisms, eventually including the bacteria. If you drop down to number 1.2, Leeuwenhoek was by no means unique in this. His English contemporary and to some extent counterpart, Robert Hooke, developed not a single-lensed but a compound microscope, and there's a picture of it on the left. It was a very beautiful, handcrafted and even gilded object, which, as you can see, also includes a very complicated light source for illuminating what it is that he's looking at. And, of course, this kind of microscope was intended to to have the specimen moved and then replaced by another specimen. Hooke obviously didn't make lots of microscopes for each of his recorded specimens. Hooke was a fascinating figure. He was a polymath, that is, he was trained in many fields. He did study at the university. He was what we would today call an engineer and a scientist capable of many areas. After the Great Fire of London, he was involved in surveying and then even was involved in architectural work in helping to restore many of the buildings that had been destroyed. And he not only did work on this, as it were, on the side in microscopy, he had been involved in his youth while at Oxford University with Boyle and the study of various gases. He did work in astronomy and was one of the first to see and describe the rings of Saturn and the craters on the moon. So he contributed a great deal to a whole variety of fields of science. And if you drop down below the pictures of his microscope, to some of the pictures that were included in his Micrographia, that is, the book he published describing his findings, you'll see that he described vinegar eels. These are very small creatures that could be seen in the lees, that is, the kind of cloudy portion of vinegar. And he also described what he called cellulae, or cells, within plants, within cork especially, and he is the first to use the term cell to describe these very small units of living material. So you can see that with the observations that Leeuwenhoek and Hooke made, and then their contemporaries and successors, one really had the beginnings, the foundations, and then really the development of the science of microbiology. The organisms, which we now know are responsible for a great deal of disease, certainly a great deal of infection, were being described and even categorized according to their size and shape. However, this information was generally of virtually no interest to the medical profession, despite the fact that many observers noted that these objects could be found on decaying material, things that stink and are obviously decomposing. Nevertheless, scientists were not always physicians, and indeed physicians often were not very interested in these newly developing sciences, and they continued to refuse to believe that these small organisms could have anything to do with the diseases that they were diagnosing and treating, despite, if you will, the mounting evidence. And it is an astonishing and peculiar fact that it would take nearly 250 years for physicians to recognize that what had been described long before by scientists was actually a very great import in their own field. And part of this, if you drop down to number 1-3, was the stubborn persistence of the older models of medical treatment and medical theory, the most popular and widespread of which was the idea of the four humors, which were regarded as in some way related to the four basic elements of earth, air, fire, and water, and therefore representing combinations of these fundamental realities. And when you think about it, in some ways, the kind of increasingly strident dogmatism of medicine, and I speak here of what we would today call internal medicine, that branch of medicine that is concerned with the prescribing of medication and the diagnosing of disease, as contrasted with surgery. As we noted in a previous lecture, the development and the continual refinement of anatomy meant that surgeons were becoming more and more specialized in describing and understanding what lies inside the body, although they were limited in what they could do by the absence of any kind of anesthesia and the absence of antisepsis, which meant that surgery very frequently, if not always, involved the introduction of dangerous infections. Well, despite the relative development within surgery, medicine, that is, the science of diagnosis and of treatment with drugs and diet and other kinds of procedures other than surgery, regarded itself as a higher and more advanced and more intellectual discipline, requiring longer study at the university and a great reverence for the sources that had gone before, sources that dated all the way back to Hippocrates and certainly to Galen. And so this theory of four humors, of we've mentioned them before, of phlegm, of blood, of black bile and yellow bile, the balance of which was thought to be the source of both health and the imbalance of which resulted necessarily in disease. If you were taught this, and you were taught that this had been established for, well, millennia, and was accepted throughout the civilized world, then someone's, you know, little querulous insistence that maybe these tiny little organisms they see have something to do with disease would naturally be met with by skepticism and profound resistance. So the forms of treatment that remained very popular, and popular right up into the 1800s, which is astonishing, include, and this is number 132, the practice of phlebotomy, that is, of bleeding the person. Because if you imagine that you believe that diseases are caused by excess of either blood or black bile or phlegm or yellow bile, then you would naturally treat them by trying to remove these substances, whatever you thought was present in excess. And so you have the very strange phenomenon of effectively the same thing being done in the 14th century, in the picture on the left, as is being done in the beginning of the 19th century on the right. The poor patient is having a certain amount of blood removed because the physician is convinced that this will help them. And if you drop down to number 133, the practice of purging the individual, of inducing vomiting with the hope that this would decrease yellow bile, or of inducing diarrhea with the hope that this would get rid of black bile. Again, this is something that was consistent right from, in this case, the 13th century right up into the beginnings of the 1800s. And in both cases, you have a physician who is administered a dose of something that is going to cause this poor person to vomit, and they're getting ready for the very unpleasant experience. And so this is a reminder that often, despite a tremendous scientific advance, if medical theory is widely convinced of its rightness, it may take a very long time, and in fact may result in a great deal of even persecution and potential martyrdom, as we'll see in the case of Ignaz Semmelweis, for individuals who attempt to, as it were, oppose the mainstream and suggest new possibilities for the development of these fields. And I've noted parenthetically at the very end that an example of the persistence of these theories can be found even in one of the most celebrated physicians who died at the beginning of the 19th century, tremendous humanitarian, who opposed slavery and was one of the founding fathers of the United States, Benjamin Rush, who was a physician and of course whom important institutions have been named. Rush really believed that you had to purge and bleed people to make them better. He believed that aggressive bleeding and purging was the way to treat most diseases, and that physicians who did not do this were neglecting their patients and the practice of medicine. Very wise, very compassionate, and even a very scientifically aware physician. And he was writing this and believing this right in the beginning of the 1800s.